Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing. Always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true transparency pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Welcome back to the Midday 180, served up by Wendy's. This is 104.5 The Zone. Chad Withrow, Paul Kuharski in studio. David Reed producing. Jonathan Hutton out today. Hopefully back tomorrow or the next day. John Feinstein on with us every Monday from the Washington Post. And John, I have to start with this. I finally had a chance to watch the Post last night. I was very impressed. Good recommendation by you.
Yeah, I don't think it took a genius to make that recommendation, Chad. I mean, even as I said to you guys 2 weeks ago, even if you aren't like me, someone who's been associated with the Post since getting out of college, which I hate to admit is 40 years ago, the movie comes off like a thriller, and it's incredibly well acted and well directed, but as somebody who's worked at the Post for all these years, in addition to just enjoying it as a movie, I felt incredible pride that I've had this little tiny role at the paper for all these years.
I thought, you know, it's tough for Tom Hanks to be underappreciated. I thought his portrayal of Ben Bradley was underappreciated. Everyone talked about Meryl Streep. I thought Tom Hanks was very compelling in that role.
Well, he was terrific. And I mean, Tom Hanks is terrific if he's reading the phone book. But the problem is that when they did All the President's Men back in the 70s, Jason Robards played Ben Bradley.
So good.
And I'm telling you, the first time I met Ben Bradley, I thought he was Jason Robards because I had just seen the movie. It came out my senior year in college. And, I mean, Robards looked like Bradley, came across like, I mean, he had Bradley. Now, Hanks had to do it differently because he doesn't look or sound like Bradley. But he was still really good in the role. And a lot of the lines that came out of his mouth were lines that absolutely could have and probably did come out of Bradley's mouth, except that Bradley was a hell of a lot more profane than Hanks was.
My only critique of the movie, I don't want to give away the ending, I feel like a movie like that in so many ways is educational to people who didn't know the full story, they need to have a little bit of a write-up at the end, the postscript about where things went from there. Because
Last line of the movie kind of gives you a strong hint.
Oh, absolutely. And it's great. Really? But I think for the people that don't know fully what exactly happened there, and unfortunately there's a lot of people in America that don't.
You know, you're right about that, Chad.
It would be good to give a little bit, okay, that last line was great. The last scene was great. I know what they were hinting at.
Yeah.
Not even really hinting at it. They were showing you. But they almost need the write-up of, now here's where the Washington Post went from there and what happened.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. And, you know, your point is well taken about how many people don't really know about Watergate and don't really know how important it was in the history of our country. And my brother, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, had his assistant call me one day just to tell me that she'd never heard of Woodward and Bernstein.
And
I was appalled. I was appalled. I mean, that should be in every history book. That's like not knowing John Kennedy was president or something like that. I mean, that's such an important part. Forget journalism. It's such an important part of American history. But I think you make a good point there, Chad.
Tiger Woods, a pretty important part of golf history, especially over the last 20, 25 years. There's something about Tiger Woods. I'm watching him make that charge yesterday. Had a great round, had a disappointing end of the round, but there's just something that feels different about Tiger Woods and his demeanor and his confidence as he was taking shots when he went on that run in that tournament. Do you sense that at all with Tiger, or are we just kind of watching, you know, a one weekend, the old Tiger that may disappear from here on out?
Well, he was the old Tiger on Saturday. I mean, when he shot the 65. You know, as you said yesterday, the minute he got onto the fringes of contention, and then obviously Webb Simpson was basically running away with it, but the minute he got just a little bit close to where, you know, a miracle could have, if Webb had come back, could have done something, he backed up. And to me, that's the difference between the old Tiger and the new Tiger. The old Tiger smelled it when he got into contention, and then he just stopped missing putts. I mean, the old Tiger never double bogey 17, never makes bogey on 14 with a wedge in his hands. But there is a difference, though, to me, besides that. And I watched his interview with Steve Sands after the round, who is now back to being Sandsy, which tells you that Tiger's in a good mood, because he puts Y's on the back of, on the end of people's names when he's happy. and he said, geez, I played great today. You know, I could have scored better, but I played great. The old Tiger might have stormed off and not talked at all. And if he did, he would have been grousing, you know, about, oh, you know, I should have shot 62 with the way I hit the ball or whatever. I think this guy, and I'm not, I don't buy into the notion that he's a new person or anything like that. I think people do evolve and they do learn and hopefully grow from mistakes and from experience. So I don't buy, but I don't buy the, oh, he's a new Tiger Woods, you know, like referring back to Watergate, the old new Nixons. But I do think he's grateful that he can play golf and that he can play golf pain free. And I think he looks at it now as opposed to the old Tiger who would say second place sucks. He looks at it now, 72 healthy holes is a pretty darn good week for me. And of course he wants to win, and of course he's still competitive as can be. But he's got a little more appreciation just for the fact that he can play pain-free golf, and that probably makes him a happier person.
John, I feel like one of the few people who really enjoy Johnny Miller on NBC's golf coverage because it is so different from a lot of other analysts. But man, will he go out of his way to take a shot when he feels like it's necessary. I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but NBC had this retrospective of Phil Mickelson hitting a shot at the TPC from years before, and they had Bones, his old caddy, who was on the course, and they had this whole pre-produced piece, everything ready to go. They played a shot from Phil Mickelson, and Bones ended it by saying, well, he had about the size of a car window to play that shot through. They go back to NBC, and Johnny Miller said, well, he also took his car back to the airport on Friday after not making the cut.
Actually, I think that's funny.
It was funny, but there was this awkward silence you could tell. And was it Dan Hicks, I think, on the call?
Dan would be in the booth with him, yeah.
Yeah, so who basically was like, hey, thanks a lot for throwing cold water on everything that we prepared for that pre-produced segment right
but
when
Dan
they came back.
Dan should be used to that after all these years. I mean, he's been in the booth now with Johnny for, gosh, close to 20 years. And look, let me say this. I've always been a big fan of Johnny Miller on TV because it's not so much that he's more willing to say a guy choked. You know, that was the big thing, the early Johnny Miller, that he would say somebody choked, and that really pissed off the players. I can remember sitting in a player's dining area in Atlanta in 1994 with three guys, and honestly, I don't even remember who it was exactly now because it was a long time ago, but they were grousing about Miller. And one of them finally says, who was he to criticize us? What did he ever do? And I looked at the guy and I said, well, he won 25 times on tour, including two majors. I sincerely doubt the three of you combined are going to come close to that. And he said, he won 25 times. I said, yes, he did. So you can disagree with him, but you can't say he doesn't have the right to say it or he didn't do enough in golf to say it. And so I've always enjoyed the fact that Miller is willing to say things that other guys aren't, but also that he says things that I haven't thought about. One of the things he said yesterday when Woods was playing the 13th hole and he played tee shot way right, you know, away from the flag, which is on the left, and he said, Johnny said, the one thing I've noticed since Tiger Woods came back is he's afraid of water. And he doesn't want to play, you know, he doesn't have enough confidence in his swing to go for a flag where water might be nearby. That was a pretty interesting comment. I don't know if it's true or not, but it made me think. And the other guy, who I think is great, and he's a friend, so I'm really biased here. I'm not biased with Miller because I know Miller to say hello, is Faraday. And Faraday said the single most honest thing you will hear on a golf telecast yesterday afternoon. When Webb Simpson was on the 16th hole, he said, you know, there are guys who play for the big trophies, the four majors. But this week, these guys are playing for money. Now, I'm sure the PGA Tour didn't want to hear that because they like to, you know, claim that the players is some kind of fifth major, which it's not. There are four majors. But that's the truth. The reason the players is a big deal to those who play is because it's got a $10 million purse.
John,
Faraday is about the only guy willing to say that.
Last week, when I think Phil and Tiger ended up playing around together.
It was Thursday and Friday they played together.
Yeah, so Phil said, we should just match play it. People would want to see a high-stakes match play match between us. I remember one that was kind of like under the lights in Arizona. Who played? Was it two guys or four guys?
There were several of them, Paul. They when Tiger was at the height of his popularity.
Is there a market for it now, and would Tiger do it?
That's a great question. He might, but see what would make the reason those things failed is because they weren't playing for their own money. Some sponsor put up the money. So what? So it's another payday for a bunch of rich guys. Now, if you said that Tiger and Phil were each going to put up $1 million, even though that's a drop in the bucket for them, maybe that would get people's attention.
Or what if it's huge for the winner and not much?
Yeah, winner take all. But again, remember 100 years ago in tennis, they had those winner-take-all matches, which turned out to be fraudulent, that the loser got paid anyway. But they were promoted as winner-take-all. I think it was $10,000, which back then was huge money. And they failed, again, because it was corporate money. So what? So some corporation loses $10,000 and Jimmy Connors gets it and John Newcomb doesn't. Who cares? And especially turned out Newcomb or whoever the loser was got $7,000. It was fraudulent.
U.S. Supreme Court changes up what states can do in terms of legalized gambling. How quickly do you expect the effect of this? Do you like the tax money opportunity? Mm-hmm. Or do you dislike the ability maybe for people to find an easy avenue to get hooked on something that might not be healthy for everybody?
Look, Paul, you know, this is sort of like prohibition. People were going to drink regardless of the law. People are going to gamble regardless of the law. If you can take some of the money that will come in and put it towards schools and you know, put it towards people who need it, then I'm 100% for it. I mean, people are going to gamble just as people were going to drink. And yes, it can be addictive. We know that. There are plenty of gambling addicts now. Now, might there be a few more when it's easier? Yeah, probably, just as there were more alcoholics when it became easier to drink. But I think that this has the potential to be a very good thing. I think it's better than lotteries because lotteries tend to corral poor people who think this is the way they're going to change their lives. Now, that's not to say that only rich people will bet. But there'll be a lot more rich and middle-class people betting than play lotteries because you feel, even though it's gambling, you feel like you have some ability to get the outcome right and win. So I think it's the right decision. And to answer your first question, I think New Jersey may already have betting set up this afternoon because they've been sitting there ready to go. They've been, you know, in the starting gate. And there will be other seats. States that will be right behind because they either have legislation ready to be approved and the logistics set up in many cases. So it won't be long before we'll see a lot of this.
John, Winnipeg beats the Preds in 7 games. They win game one over Vegas. And I'm looking at these two stories that are polar opposites, but both certain stories in the NHL. Mm-hmm. One is Vegas in year one. It was essentially handed a great team by the new expansion rules to be relevant right out of the gates in Vegas. Then you have Winnipeg, a team who had to move back to that city that struggled for years and is finally breaking through this year. Is it the American way to root for Winnipeg in this series, even though they're the Canadian team, to root for the guys who had to struggle at some point and they weren't just handed a great team?
Yeah, but I don't agree with you, Chad. I don't think Vegas was handed a great team. They were certainly given the opportunity to put together a better expansion team than we've seen in past expansions in all sports. But and I'm biased here. I always tell you guys when I have a bias. George McPhee was the general manager here in Washington for 18 years. He's one of the really good guys in sports. I consider him a friend. He sent me a Vegas Golden Knights pullover before the season started with a note saying, I have knighted you. So he knighted me for crying out loud. So I'm biased, but I think they've done a tremendous job. to be as good as they've been, to get to the Final Four in their first year. It's not like they were handed a bunch of all-stars. They were handed a bunch of good players, and they've made the most of it, and they picked Fleury, who'd won a Stanley Cup as a goalie already, and here they are in the Final Four. I think Winnipeg's a great story, too. You realize there's only one team in this Final Four that's won a Stanley Cup, and that's Tampa Bay, which won back in 06. Washington Capitals have been around since 1974. They've never won a cup. And believe me, sitting where I am right now, the whole city is going crazy at the thought that the Caps might finally break through and win the cup. So there's not a bad story among the four. If I were to pick one team I'd like to see win, honestly, it'd be Vegas 1 and then Winnipeg 2.
Well, and I was going to ask you about just the resurrection of the Caps and Barry Trotz. He was all but fired.
Yep.
After losing the first two playoff games at home, they were already talking about his replacement. They battled back in that series. They beat Pittsburgh, the two-time defending Stanley Cup champion. Now they're up 2-0 on the road in Tampa Bay. What about this Washington story and the way Barry Trotz has come back from the dead?
Well, the funny thing about it, Chad, is that a mistake he made, in my opinion, may have been played a key role in them being where they were, because he decided to go with Philip Grubauer in the first two games of that Columbus series. Grubauer had played well down the stretch. Holpe had a bad spell. Braden Holpe had a bad spell in February, a really bad spell for a guy who's been a good goalie for a long time. Guy won the Vezina Trophy a couple of years ago. And he started Grubauer, which I thought was a mistake. They lose the first two games. They bring Holpe back. Holpe has been unbelievable since he's come back. They're 10-2 since they put him back in goal. Holpe's a terrific goalie. And he's never had that great playoff until now. And maybe sitting and watching those first two games did something to him mentally. But he's been terrific. And you're right about Barry Trotz, because he had gotten the label, not unlike the label he had in Nashville. Really good coach, can't win deep into the playoffs. And they hadn't gone past the second round, and partly because of this screwy NHL system where you can have the top two seeds in the conference meeting in the second round, as happened with the Predators and the Jets. So I think that he probably would have been fired, and certainly would have been fired if they lost to Columbus. Might very well have been fired if they lost to Pittsburgh. And it's funny because I do a regular radio hit here in Washington, and after the first two games I said against Columbus, the four hosts who are big fans were saying, oh, they're choking again, they're done, they're going. I said, I think they're going to win this series. I said, I can't promise you they'll beat Pittsburgh, but I just think they're a better team than Columbus, and we all know in hockey, home ice doesn't make that big a difference. And you should have seen the tweets I got from people telling me to just shut up. I didn't know anything about hockey. You know, we're entitled to panic given the past, blah, 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 blah. Well, now everybody's sort of celebrating, even though they haven't won anything yet.
John, I know you love a soccer question. This isn't much about...
Love them, Paul.
Not much about tactics, obviously. United there in D.C. is in line to get Wayne Rooney.
Yes.
I saw some EPL talk this week, an analyst saying he should have hung around and at least to see what Everton did, because a change there could have created new opportunity for him. Then I saw a lot of American reaction, some of which is another, you know, European guy at the end coming here, takes away opportunity, puts them at risk of being the old NASL, and another segment that wants to see a guy like Rooney who could still contribute in the States. Just wondering where you come down on all of that.
Well, I mean, look, if you are one of the best players in the world, as Wayne Rooney was, why would you want to play in MLS? You want to play in the Premier League. You want to play in the Bundesliga. You want to play in La Liga, you know, the best leagues in the world. It's like saying, you know, that if you're Tom Brady and you're 28 years old, that you want to go play in some minor league in Europe, because that's what the MLS is compared to the leagues in the world. But when you get to the end of your career, and Rooney has not been a star in the Premier League for, what, 3 or 4 years, would you say, Paul?
Yeah.
Last couple of years at Man United, certainly hasn't lit it up at Everton, except for that one little streak he had the fall where he did play very well. I think he had 9 goals in 11 games or something ridiculous like that. So he still got something. So I think having him come over here to play, even though he's near the end, even though he's not the player that he once was, I think it's great for MLS. And he's going to make a lot of money to come over here and play. And he did get to go and play in his hometown in Everton for a couple of years. It didn't work out especially well, but why not? I remember, this is how old I am, referencing the NASL, when Pelé and Johan Cruyff came here to play, Pelé for the Cosmos and Johan Cruyff first in Los Angeles and then here in Washington, it created an electricity around the NASL that was unbelievable. The Cosmos were playing in front of 75,000 people every night in Giant Stadium. The Diplomats, when Cruyff was here, had a crowd of 53,000. I covered it for a Cosmos game and averaged close to 30,000. The problem was the league got cocky and thought, oh, we're a big-time league now because we've got a couple franchises doing very well, and they expanded from 12 to 24 teams like that. And 5 years later, they were out of business. I don't think MLS is going to make that mistake, and I think Rooney coming over here would be terrific, especially because I think DC is still an important franchise in the MLS, and they've really struggled the last few years.
John, in the NBA, you've got Dwayne.
I didn't think I knew that much about soccer.
That was good.
That was a great, maybe your best soccer answer of all time, John. We got to put that in the Hall of Fame.
Put that on wax.
Yeah. In the NBA, Dwayne Casey wins NBA Coach of the Year, and he's fired
right
at the end of the season by Toronto. Brad Stevens doesn't get a single vote. And right now, he looks like the greatest basketball coach on the planet with what he's done without his two best players and after annihilating LeBron James and the Cavs in Game 1. What do you make of Brad Stevens and the Celtics right now and the story with Dwayne Casey in Toronto?
Well, let's go in order. Dwayne Casey. I don't think Dwayne Casey was the coach of the year. I think probably maybe it was Brad Stevens or Mike D'Antoni. But Dwayne Casey did a fine job. They won over 50 games for the third straight year. They won 59. They were number one seed in the East. But then they bombed out in the playoffs again and really got annihilated by Cleveland. I think it may not have been the fact that they lost to the Cavaliers, but it looked like they quit after Game 1. Those last three games were embarrassing. And that's on the coach to some degree. Now, does that mean you should get fired after you've been as good as Dwayne Casey has been? I don't think so, and my question always is, when you fire a coach, who have you got who's coming in who's better? You know? So, and I don't know that Toronto has any idea who's coming in. It felt like that their general manager had a temper tantrum after they got beat the way they did and just said, oh, that's it, you know, Dwayne Casey, I'm going to fire him. As far as Brad Stevens is concerned, first of all, I wouldn't get carried away by one game. It's amazing. I was watching toward the end of that game. I don't know if you guys were watching, but they put Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson on camera because Van Gundy's been on the Celtics right from the beginning of these playoffs, to his credit. But they were talking as if the series was over. I mean, how many times have you seen teams blown out in Game 1 and they come back and win the series? It happens all the time. And you don't count out LeBron James. That being said, I believe Brad Stevens was a great basketball coach since he was at Butler. To take Butler to back-to-back national championship games, remember that 2010 team that almost beat Duke, lost Gordon Hayward, and then came back and almost won the national title a year later.
That's right.
And I was surprised when he left college basketball. I beat myself up for this because I had written a long column on Brad during his last season at Butler. Zat had a long breakfast with him, talked about his future. You know, will you stay at Butler? Would you go to Duke or North Carolina or Kansas or one of the glamour jobs? I never brought up the NBA. It never crossed my mind he might go to the NBA. Now, I wasn't alone, but as you guys know, I like to think I'm smarter than most people. But I totally missed that one, was shocked when he took the Celtics job, but he's been remarkable from day one. They've improved every year since he got there. He took over a bad team. And to lose Gordon Hayward for the season, to lose Kyrie Irving for the playoffs, and to be doing what they're doing. Now, they've got some good young players, but they're really young. Just tells me that Brad Stevens is a generational coach. He's a generational coach. He'll go down ultimately he's going to be in the Basketball Hall of Fame. I believe that.
John Feinstein is a generational guest here on the Midday 180 also. John, thanks
only
so much.
I'm on for so long.
That's right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, John.
All right, guys. Talk to you next week.
John Feinstein on with us every Monday here on the Midday 180.